copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I come from New Zealand. I was a medical missionary in Africa, but for the last 22 years I've been with the Christian Medical Fellowship in Britain. In 8 years as head of student ministries and then 14 years as the CEO. So my work is quite broad across a whole lot of areas, including evangelism, apologetics, bioethics, medical mission, team leadership, and so on. And my specialty was in general surgery. And I think that word general is important. I'm very much a generalist. I'm not an academic. I'm interested in the big picture. And I suppose I see my role really in this whole area as listening and trying to understand what the academics are saying and putting it into the language of the street. So my burden is really to see ordinary people in the churches becoming deeply biblical and thinking through where they stand so that they know how to act in the world. And I put right at the beginning of your handout here this mentioned this verse, which refers to the men of Issachar from 1 Chronicles 12, one group of David's men. And we're told of the men of Issachar, one of the tribes of Israel, that they were people who understood the times and who knew what to do. And I think that's a good challenge for us in the age in which we live, for Christians in any age, that we understand what's happening in the world and we know what to do as believers, because we're grounded in God's word. And John Stott, to whom many of us owe a real debt for his service to the church, will remember that he talked about the importance of double listening for Christians, that we're people who have the word of God in one hand and the world of God in the other, and that we bring the two together. So in addressing this issue on values and morals and their origin, what I first want to do is to sketch out what's happening in the world at the moment in the area of bioethics especially, and the way that secular thinking is beginning to shape this. And then after we've laid out the stall of what's happening medically, philosophically, in the whole area of bioethics, then we'll come back and focus on the Bible again and try and build from that a Christian framework, both a Christian anthropology and a Christian basis for ethics. So I hope that will be useful. But it's going to be big picture rather than academic detail, because I'm afraid I can only do what I can do. Okay. So first I want just to sketch out for you what's happening in bioethics under a number of headings. And I'm going to start with abortion, because I think abortion was really the great watershed in the last 50 years, and everything has followed on from the change of thinking about that. Now, abortion has been practiced by most societies at some level throughout most of history. But the important thing to grasp is that legalized abortion on a massive scale, on an industrial scale, is a very recent phenomenon in world history. And it really began in what became the former Soviet Union back in the 1920s, then in Scandinavia, and then Britain was the first country outside Scandinavia and Europe to legalize abortion. China and India were a decade or two earlier. And then the US, so 67 in Britain, 73 Roe versus Wade in the US, and then of course to the situation where 80% of the world's countries have effectively legalized it. And that means that the younger generation is growing up at a time when they've known nothing different. And so they think that a situation which two generations ago would be regarded as absolutely horrendous is quite normal. So we're now at the point where there are, the generally accepted figure is 42 million abortions per year worldwide. Now, you've got to put that up against 50 million civilian and military deaths throughout the whole of the Second World War, or put it up against 57 million deaths per year from all other causes other than abortion. Okay? So about 100 million human beings die every year. 42 million of them are unborn children. Now, what's happened more recently is that the abortion rate's starting to come down worldwide. And it's coming down for two main reasons. In China, there is rethinking about the one-child policy, which, along with sex selection abortion in India, has led to the phenomenon where we have 160 million missing women in South Asia and East Asia because girls are being selectively aborted rather than boys. And of course, everything that creates in a society where there's not enough women to go around, the way that feeds into the whole human trafficking debate. But now there's a sense that because of the demographic effects, for purely pragmatic reasons, the Chinese are starting, at least in rural areas, to relax the one-child policy. And then in Eastern Europe, but particularly Russia, former Soviet Union, there is big concern about what massive legalized abortion did to the demography of the country. So, you know, in countries like Romania, Russia, there were at least two abortions for every live birth for a long period of time. And what that does is that it changes the age structure of the population so that you get a hugely disproportionate number of elderly people. And so Putin is now promoting the keeping of children and tightening up on abortion laws in an interesting way. So there's abortion. Then artificial reproduction, of course, is a relatively recent phenomenon going back to the first test tube baby in 1978, but now a massive commercial venture worldwide and fueled by growing levels of infertility relating to the sexual revolution, sexually transmitted disease, but also by the fact that abortion has contributed to there not being many babies available for adoption. So people are looking for technological solutions. One in every 11 couples is infertile. And so we've had IVF and GIFT and surrogacy, and now we have the situation where a child can have five different parents: the one who donates the egg, the one who gives the sperm, the commissioning couple, and then the surrogate who carries the baby, because the mother who wants to adopt it doesn't want to become pregnant. And surrogacy is now becoming a massive commercial thing, particularly in the developing world, where wealthy couples from the north are commissioning couples in India and so on to have children. Expect to read much more about that. Prenatal selection and genetics. Of course, the idea once we unraveled the genetic code was that we'd be able to shape and eliminate genetic diseases, to identify them. In practice, of course, it's much easier to identify a so-called defective gene and then destroy the individual. And so coupled with the idea that life before birth is not really human life, you can practice what is in effect a negative eugenics policy. And so we now have the technology that there are about 6,000 diseases which can be inherited, and we now have the technology increasingly to identify those. And so we can test at three different stages, either at the pre-implantation stage with an embryo by taking off a cell and examining it, or at the 8 to 10 week stage through chorion villus biopsy, or at the 18 to 20 week stage through amniocentesis, where you can look. And it used to be just about conditions like Down syndrome. In most Western countries, between 90 and 95% of babies with Down syndrome, an extra 21st chromosome, that are identified prenatally are aborted. Okay, but it's now going to be available for more and more inherited conditions. And of course, that includes conditions which just give you a propensity or a possibility that you might, for example, be more likely to get breast cancer later in life. So raises these questions. Stem cells, cloning, and animal hybrids. We haven't got time to go into the detail of this. My comment would be that back in the late 90s, we were being told that embryonic stem cell technology would provide cures for all sorts of diseases. We were told more recently, at least in Britain, that the use of animal-human hybrids, cytoplasmic hybrids, using both animal and human genetic material would provide a source of stem cells that would do the same thing. I think these are largely dead in the water now, 15 years later, because we've just not seen the predicted advances. And whilst a lot of people still talk about them, but we're seeing the big companies shifting their investment into more profitable areas. And so the real advances are being made at the moment in the whole area of adult stem cell technology. So it's an extension of what we've been doing with blood transfusions for many years of blood cells are now being used increasingly with other cell lines, taking adult stem cells or umbilical stem cells, which we regard as a much more ethical source, and being able to develop treatments for the kind of diseases that result from cell loss. So, you know, everything from diabetes to Parkinson's disease and so on and so forth. Euthanasia has not advanced as fast as one might have expected. I think that internationally that is because Christians have not been alone in opposing it, but there have been very strong co-belligerent groups, particularly the medical profession and the disability rights lobby worldwide. And so whereas you see my next heading of same-sex marriage, where same-sex marriage is coming in very rapidly. You look at the growing number of US states and countries around the world which are legalizing it. The push to euthanasia started earlier, but it's much slower in its progression. So we still only have four European countries which have legalized assisted suicide, euthanasia, or both. So that's the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and Switzerland, and no other country outside, and only three US states. And I think what's particularly striking is that there have been about 150 attempts to legalize assisted suicide or euthanasia through different US states in the last 15 years or so. And all of these through state parliaments have failed, with one exception, Vermont, which is a very liberal state, which legalized it a year ago, and where there's not been a single case of assisted suicide carried out under the law. So, but euthanasia is, the pressure is there and it's on the horizon, and we always thought same-sex marriage would be the last skittle to fall in Western civilization, but it's going to be euthanasia, I think, will now be the last one. And all these issues relate together. Just as I've said, abortion has an impact on infertility and creates a demand, therefore, because there aren't babies available for adoption. And in the same way, it's been said by some commentators that the generation which killed its children is at great risk of being killed by its children. So the generation that killed its children through abortion is at great risk of being killed by its children through euthanasia. Why? Well, it's all about demography. And if you look at a country like Japan, go back to 1950, you'll see that in 1950, 35% of the Japanese population were under the age of 15, and 5% were over the age of 65. And by 2050, it will be 8% under the age of 15 and 30% over the age of 65. And you add into that changing demography the fact that the percentage in the working age of 15 to 65 is getting smaller, and add in toxic debt, unemployment, and increasing welfare payments and so on, and you can see where this is going, okay? Unless there is a change. Same-sex marriage, of course, we're all aware of. And then finally, the deconstruction of gender, marriage, and reproduction. What do I mean by that? Well, let me just illustrate it with an example. There was a story in Britain last week where it's a front-page story in the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Mail, where they were reporting on the fact that children in a British clinic who were gender confused were being given hormones to delay the onset of puberty, to give them more time to decide whether they're going to be boys or girls. Okay. This was children as young as 9. So a little girl of 9 believes she's a boy in a girl's body. She's going to be distressed, it's argued, by the male hormones changing her body, the female hormones changing her body into a woman. And so it's recommended that she's given hormones to delay the onset of puberty for 4 or 5 years so that she can then decide whether she wants to be a boy or a girl. In other words, the idea behind this is that gender is actually a social construct and not something that is determined. Now, we see that in the way that psychiatrists are thinking about it. The psychiatrists have a thing called the DSM, the Diagnostic Screening Manual, which lays out all the different mental disorders that there are. And you see the way worldviews are changing in with regard to what is regarded as a disorder and what isn't. And in the DSM-4, we have a condition called gender identity disorder, okay, where someone who's transgender is seen as having a mental disorder. In other words, a false belief that they are the other sex. In other words, it's seen very much in the same way as anorexia nervosa, where a person believes they're fat when we would say they're not actually fat, but they believe they're fat, so they diet inappropriately. A body dysphoria. And gender identity disorder used to be seen in that way. But under the DSM-5, the latest version which has come out, it's been renamed as gender dysphoria, and it's not regarded as a disorder anymore. It's only regarded as a disorder if it upsets the person and stops their social functioning. So the argument is that gender is actually a social construct. It doesn't matter what your genes are, it doesn't matter what your hormones say. What's important is what you think you are, and that's your real gender. And there is a move internationally to rethink gender, marriage, and reproduction. All as social, they're all social constructs, which a male-dominated society is defined in a certain way. But there's no reason why your chromosomes have to determine what sex you are. Or there's no model, there's no sort of default model of marriage. It can be 2 men, 2 women, or 3 people together. And in the same way, reproduction, technology has allowed us to do it in all sorts of different ways so that you can have 5 parents. So expect to see more and more of this. So that's the stuff that's happening. Why is it all happening? Well, we've got to look at the medical and philosophical background over the last 40 or 50 years. And obvious thing, first of all, is technological advance. 100 years ago, there's very little that medicine can do. Now we have gene therapy and ventilators and nanotechnology, and people are talking about transhumanism and robotic technology. So you can do a lot more. It obviously raises more ethical questions. Media influence and consumerism and the rise of the internet means media influence and the internet means is that all this knowledge is much more widely accessible, and something that's reported in an obscure medical journal becomes headline news all over the world very, very quickly, before even the scientists in the field are aware of it and then having to comment on it. And there's this undercurrent of consumerism that we should be able to have what we want to have. Financial constraints, the collapse of the welfare state, inadequate funding, the growth of biotechnology companies are all having an influence on what gets developed and used. And all of this is happening in a moral vacuum in a post-Christian world where there's no real consensus anymore about what is right or wrong. And looking back, the philosophical background to all this with which we're well familiar, and I'm going to go through this very quickly, but of course in Europe for for many hundred years, most people were Christian theists in terms of worldview, and then the two big threats to that in the 19th century following the Enlightenment were, first of all, higher criticism of the New Testament, which cast great doubt on the authority of the Bible, and then also, of course, Darwinism, which gave an intellectually respectable alternative for origins other than creation. And so it created a platform whereby atheism could become an intellectually credible worldview. And we're led now to the point where the corridors of power, if you like, the mountains of our culture, things like the judiciary, parliament, media, arts, entertainment, the universities, tend to be increasingly populated by people who have an atheistic worldview. God doesn't exist, death is the end, morality is arbitrary or can be discovered by the scientific method. And on the other hand, the ethics of secular humanism, which tends to be, with regard to the issues I've talked about, pro-choice, pro-euthanasia, pro-everything as a social construct, and very strongly pro-gay marriage. And this shift in worldview from Christian theism to atheism, secular humanism, has been reflected in changes in ethical codes as well. So I don't know how many of you this week have been to Auschwitz or went last year. I went on Saturday, very, very sobering. But one of the things that happened after Auschwitz, primarily because of the involvement of the medical profession in that, and the history is very interesting, we haven't got time to go into it, but it has been argued that the Holocaust would never have happened if it wasn't for the collaboration of the German medical profession, because in fact what ended in Auschwitz began at the beginning of the war in psychopedic and geriatric and psychiatric hospitals. It was the clearing out of those hospitals, and then the medical staff and auxiliary staff were transferred to Auschwitz, having been, in a sense, numbed to initiate the program that the SS then took on. But because of the involvement in the medical profession and scientists in the Holocaust, it was felt there was a need to restate all the ethical codes after the Second World War finished. So we'd always had the Hippocratic Oath for 2,000 years, in which it says, for example, I will give no deadly medicine to anyone, nor suggest such counsel, and nor will I give a woman a pessary to produce abortion. So profoundly pro-life, the Hippocratic Oath. And so they then introduced the declarations like the Declaration of Geneva and the International Code of Medical Ethics, which understated those Hippocratic and, we would argue, Judeo-Christian principles. So the Declaration of Geneva says, for example, I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception, even against threat. I will not use my medical knowledge contrary to the laws of humanity. And that was embraced not just by the World Medical Association and every national medical association around the world. And that was 1948. So it's only 60 or so years ago that we have a profoundly pro-life ethical declaration. So what's happened since that time is that with the growth and dominance of atheism and secular humanism as an ideology in the Western world, that's been displaced. And all of these codes have, in accordance with that change in worldview, been amended to reflect that different thinking. And so, for example, in 1983, the Declaration of Geneva was amended so that instead of saying, I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception, it now says, I'll maintain the utmost respect for human life from its beginning. But beginning is left conveniently undefined. And then we saw the emergence of secular bioethics as a new specialty, with proliferation of journals and university departments. That the skeptics will say that secular bioethics came along because the philosophers could see the writing on the wall. No one was interested in philosophy anymore, so in order to maintain their tenure, they had to change their profession. And so they invented this new profession called bioethics, and they all moved into that area. Well, that's what the skeptics would say. And so we've seen the rise of secular bioethics, and it has reflected this change of worldview. Probably one of the best known figures would be Peter Singer, who you may well have heard of. Peter Singer was an Australian who was a professor of bioethics at Monash University in Melbourne and subsequently moved to the States. But he is famous for his book Animal Liberation, which in a sense laid the philosophical framework for the animal rights movement back in the 1970s. But he's also well known for the concept of speciesism, and his seminal article, Sanctity of Life versus Quality of Life, which was published in 1983 in the American journal Pediatrics, really laid out his stall, as it were. And what he said in that article was that we need to get rid of the concept of the sanctity of life, that all human life is precious, because it's based on what he said was, quote unquote, religious mumbo jumbo. And we need to replace this policy with a new concept of quality of life. And the idea behind quality of life is that the value of a human life is not contingent simply on the fact that it's human, but on the capacities that it has. And so what follows from that is that human life that has a higher capacity for intellectual engagement or relationship or cognition is of more value than life which doesn't. And clearly that has repercussions if you're an embryo, a fetus, or someone with dementia. And Singer follows this through, and one of his books is titled Should the Baby Live? And of course, you don't have to read the whole book to know that the answer is not if it doesn't have dot, dot, dot. And so this intersects with Singer's animal rights stuff, because he would argue that Christians are speciesist. In other words, they discriminate against other species simply on the basis that they're not human, and that we should be valuing all life according to its intellectual capacity. So what follows from that is that you might have a chimpanzee or a dolphin or perhaps even a lower animal which is of more value than a severely disabled child or an embryo or whatever. The politicization of Darwinism, what do I mean by that? Well, we've got to separate Darwinism as a biological theory from Darwinism as a kind of philosophical construct, because what Hitler did, in a sense, was to take the survival of the fittest or the non-survival of the weakest and to politicize it. In other words, he made the non-survival of the weakest a public duty, which was embraced by the state and in which people had to cooperate. And what was behind a lot of this was strengthening the gene pool of the German nation at that time. And as I say, it began with disabled children, with elderly people, with psychogeriatrics, people with psychiatric conditions, but then ultimately spread to, you know, everyone who wasn't Aryan, effectively. And I would argue that what we're actually seeing now is the same kind of politicization of Darwinism, the same sort of eugenics, but it's carried out in a different way. It's done prenatally, because we now have the technology that Hitler didn't have. And B, it's done not through coercion, but through giving choice to people. And what's very interesting, if you go back to the Holocaust, the very first death in Nazi Germany was that of a baby who was blind and deaf with limb abnormalities, who was given a lethal injection by Karl Brandt, Hitler's physician, who later came to oversee the euthanasia program. and the killing of that baby happened with its parents' consent. And in fact, the 6,000 children who were killed in the pediatric program were all killed with parental consent. So you see, it was all about choice, and then the coercion came later. And I would argue that in a sense what we're seeing now is you make a choice available to people, and you argue that there will be less suffering and more freedom if we embrace this choice. And that choice is to ensure that people with certain disabilities, you know, are not born, because they'll weaken our families and weaken society. Anyway, we can come back to the new eugenics, if you like. And then what happens is that the main driver then becomes what's affordable and what's going to save the most money. And I find it very interesting that back in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, there was a lot of work done into cost effectiveness. Children were asked in schools how many houses could be built for young couples. This is in mathematics exams. How many houses could be built for young couples for the money that is used currently to house the insane? And then children would be given these figures and make these calculations, you see. And you see the same sort of discussions in medical journals today, but it's all about the cost effectiveness of the prenatal screening for Down syndrome, for example. So we say, this is the cost of supporting children with Down syndrome throughout life. This is the cost of screening people and selectively aborting them. Now, how do we measure that up? So cost effectiveness becomes the driver. Now, in terms of the secular ethical framework, so with the rise of bioethics, we've seen different schools of bioethics come out, and we haven't got time other than just to delineate what some of these are. But if you ask the question, how do people make ethical decisions and decide what's right or wrong? Well, there are lots of different ways, but at a popular level, conscience, feelings, and consensus are very important. So what is wrong is what makes me feel guilty. What's right is what doesn't make me feel guilty, or what makes me feel good or bad, or what the consensus is changing. And the thing about all these things, whether it's conscience or feelings or consensus, is that they're very changeable over time and within an individual and within a society. So they're all malleable concepts. When we come to ethical frameworks, there are three main ways that people build these in the post-Christian era. The first one is the deontological approach, where you decide things are right or wrong on the basis of whether the decision conforms to a set of principles. And it goes back to John Stuart Mill, effectively. But deontology, the deontological approach, has been extremely influential and is taught in most medical schools. And the scheme that's used now is something that was developed at Georgetown University in Washington by two ethicists called Beecham and Childress. And what Beecham and Childress did was that they said, we needed a new framework in which to discuss ethics in this sort of post-Christian era. And so they said, let's pick out some principles that all of us will agree on, and then we can use those in order to have our ethical discourse. And they picked out four principles, and those principles were, first of all, autonomy, honouring individual choice. Secondly, beneficence, doing what is good. Thirdly, non-maleficence, not doing what is bad. And then finally, justice, doing what's fair. And Beecham and Childress effectively said, well, we all agree in the importance of these four principles, so let's talk about ethics. Now, of course, you could see the problems. I mean, what is beneficence? Well, it depends on your worldview. You can't divorce it from that. And then secondly, what do you do when these principles conflict? So when autonomy conflicts with beneficence, then do you force the person to do what's good for them, or do you allow them a choice? know. And then, of course, the most fundamental problem with this that it never addressed was what is it that constitutes a person to whom we owe these duties? And so, you know, I think it's risible, really, that this is this crazy form of thinking has spread all over the world. But you'll see a lot of discourse in ethical journals is according to the Georgetown mantra, it's been called, these four principles. And then, secondly, there's the consequentialist approach, that things are right or wrong on the basis of the consequences of those decisions. So this is utilitarianism, comes back to Jeremy Bentham, if you like, philosophically. And of course, there are problems with that as well. Consequences can be very difficult to judge, for example. There's the whole question, as we heard this morning from John, motives are actually quite important as well. You can do the right thing for the wrong reason and vice versa. And then we'd say that ends and means are important. You know, it's not just the outcome that's important, but it's the means by which we achieve it. Pol Pot eliminated leprosy from Kampuchea. We'd say eliminating leprosy is a good aim, would we not? Good end, but the means by which he did it was ethically questionable. The SS X-ray battalion during the Second World War eliminated tuberculosis. They took X-rays of people who had TB, they shot them. I would say eliminating TB is a good end, but the means. So ends and means are important. So that there are problems there. And then virtue ethics, which of course, you know, goes back to Plato, the idea that to make a good ethical decision you have to be a virtuous person, but then of course it begs questions about what virtue is, and that of course depends on a worldview as well. So we're now in this situation where we've got this massive explosion of technology, we're able to do all these things, we have no moral consensus about how to decide it. Lots of secular frameworks have grown up, all of which have deficiencies, and the whole thing is a huge mess. And what it means from a practical point of view, and I put here under point 3E, is that four principles have become overwhelmingly important. The first one is autonomy. Respecting choice, and you'll see whenever ethics is debated, whether it's prenatal diagnosis or whether it's euthanasia, autonomy is one of the major arguments driving it. Autonomy, we want it. Personal peace, the maximizing pleasure, or more importantly, minimizing suffering, embracing the route which will maximise my personal peace and minimise my suffering. Technology, why not? And then moral relativism, technology, we can do it. Moral relativism, why not? No reason not to embrace. So when a new technology comes along, the questions are not, as it used to be, how does this square with principles of biblical morality? Increasingly, they're not even asking how does it fit with the Georgetown mantra or with a consequentialist approach, or is it virtuous? People are not asking those questions at a popular or at even an academic level now. It's much more autonomy, personal peace, technology and moral relativism. In other words, we want it. We need it, we can do it, why not? And if you apply this to, well, let's take the example of 9-year-old girls who are sexual identity confused, not being given hormones, and then later having surgery and hormone treatment to change them into boys. We want it, we need it, we can do it, why not? So, how do we approach this as Christians? Well, Thomas Sydenham was an English doctor who was a Puritan, lived in the 17th century around the time of Bunyan. And of course, so he lived through the plague, which was 1665 was the great plague in Britain. 1666, the Great Fire of London. It was a very traumatic kind of time. And Sydenham was a brilliant doctor. He was a polymath, and his name's now associated in medicine with lots of different diseases because of his contribution. And he was also a Puritan and a deeply committed Bible-believing Christian. And when he spoke to his students at the beginning of each year, he would explain to them the Christian basis of medicine. And one of the things he said is that human beings are incredibly precious. And they're precious for two reasons. The first is that human beings are made in the image of God. And the second reason they're precious is because God himself gave nobility to the human race by becoming a human being in the person of Jesus Christ. And so he said, doctors practicing medicine should remember that they themselves are human and that they will not escape illness and disease and death, so that they should practice with great empathy, knowing their patients are their fellow sufferers. And he said also that they should remember that at the end of the day, at the end of the age, they will stand before the Almighty, and they'll have to give an account of the way that they've used the skills that he gave them as a gift of stewardship. See, profoundly Christian worldview. And of course, this brings us to the whole concept of the imago Dei, the image of God. And we're told human beings are made in God's image. We're not given in the scriptures an exposition of what that actually means, but we can pick up clues from the first chapters of Genesis that human beings are, like God, creative. They're given capacity to do things. They're rational. They are relational, made for relationship with God and for each other. And they are moral beings who can make moral decisions. And so this is the beginning of our framework. And I think in developing a Christian ethical framework that it involves, first of all, sharing the mind of Christ, the way I like to think about it. And to share the mind of Christ, we first need to have a Christian worldview. So we've got to think about the world in the way that Jesus does, in the way the Bible teaches. And you know, the creation, the fall, that we are... We've fallen from grace. It's affected every aspect of our lives, our bodies, our emotional well-being, our relationships, our moral decisions, so that we are masterpieces, but we're flawed masterpieces, and that God has initiated this great plan of redemption through his dealings with Israel and sending of Christ, through his death and resurrection, and that we're looking for a grand consummation and a new heaven and a new earth which is coming. And so we share the mind of Christ in having that linear view of history and direction of where it's all going. But then we also have the ethical principles, some of which I've alluded to already, stewardship, that we're given skills and abilities not in order to exploit the earth, but to be its vanguards, its stewards, caring for the earth and for each other in the same way that God would care. We're God's vice regents. And of course, that obviously applies to scientific knowledge and technology as well, that he's given it to us. And in fact, you know, we see the beginnings of science, don't we, in Adam going out and starting taxonomy by naming, and then the technology development in the later chapters. The sanctity of life, that every human being is precious in God's sight because it's made in the image of God. Chastity, so sexual faithfulness, that as we learn ultimately in the New Testament, that the pattern of one man, one woman for life, from Genesis 2:24 is a beautiful picture or metaphor of Christ's marriage with the church and points eschatologically to the new Jerusalem and the new heaven and the new earth. Veracity, the telling of truth, because God is truthful and tells no lies. Justice, both at an individual and corporate level, so that particularly those who are weak and can be exploited are protected from exploitation. So the orphan, the widow, all that sort of stuff. And so much of the Old Testament law, of course, is about guarding the weak. Compassion for others, grace, giving people what they don't deserve, mercy, not giving them what they do deserve, so that we're called to share the mind of Christ, both in worldview and ethics. And then we're called, secondly, to keep the commands of Christ. And what starts in the Old Testament as the Old Covenant, the Ten Commandments, the 613 laws of the Pentateuch, are, of course, a shadow prophetically pointing to the person of Christ, who will be the only one who fulfills them. And so we're to walk in the footsteps of Christ. And so in the New Testament, it becomes, first of all, in the Sermon on the Mount, we see Christ going beyond the mere external legalities of Old Testament law to the very spirit of love that underlies it. And then within the epistles, we're called to be imitators of God, be imitators of Christ, to walk in the way that he walks, as John says. So to have the mind of Christ, to keep the commands of Christ, and then, of course, to show the character of Christ, because it's not just about what we do, it's about how we're doing it. And this gets back to Plato's idea that actually, in order to act virtuously, you have to be a virtuous person. And one can only act virtuously in reality by being born again and transformed inwardly by the Holy Spirit, so that one develops those qualities of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, the fruit of the Spirit, so that in the really difficult situations where it requires incredible character to do the right thing, we're enabled by God's Spirit to walk in the footsteps of Christ. So I've referenced there the fruit of the Spirit and the love chapter. And then finally, carrying the cross of Christ, to walk in Christ's footsteps. And I think this means two things in a world that's hostile to Christian faith and values. It means, first of all, that we are prepared to fulfill the law of Christ. The law of Christ is an interesting concept. It's mentioned twice in the New Testament, as far as I know. One of them is in 1 Corinthians 9, where Paul says, I'm not under the law, but I'm under Christ's law. And then in Galatians 6:2, we have the command, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. And I think it all links up with Christ's word to his disciples at the Last Supper, you know, a new commandment I give to you, love one another as I have loved you. And if you like, it's the very opposite of the Darwinist ethic of the weak being sacrificed for the strong. It is actually the strong making sacrifices for or laying down their lives for the weak. And so this is the guiding ethic, I think, to everything we see in the New Testament. I mean, even the ethics of giving. Christ, who was rich, became poor so that you might be rich. Why? So that you might then become poor to make others rich. So we're called to emulate Christ in making sacrifices for laying down our lives for the weak. But then I think also part of the cross in a society hostile to Christian faith and values is that we're prepared to speak and act in godly ways, even when it's tremendously costly. In other words, even when it leads to great opposition to us. So, and I think that is part of the cross. Now, we see Christ, of course, bore burdens of others and carried out great acts of compassion, of healing and love that we saw. But he wasn't crucified for those acts of compassion. Certainly Caiaphas and Annas were quite concerned about Lazarus being raised from the dead and thought that it might lead to a lot of people recognizing Christ as the Messiah. But what he was crucified for was not his actions. It was actually his words. It was when he spoke unpalatable truth about his own identity and when he spoke prophetically about the nation in which he was placed. That was when it really came to bear. So I'd argue that as Christ's people living in this age, that we're called to carry the cross of Christ, and that involves both sacrificial service but also faithful speaking of the truth, regardless of the cost of that, whether it's preaching the gospel or speaking moral truth into the public square. I've listed in the last section there some pitfalls for evangelicals on ethics. We haven't got time to look at these, but I think these are misconceptions. I looked at these in more detail in the seminar I did yesterday in the workshops, but situation ethics, cheap grace and diversity are issues I think which are very much alive and well in the church at the moment, and which account for the fact that ethics are often not taught effectively in our churches, and for the huge degree of ethical confusion that there is among Christians. The classic example of that recently has been the whole gay marriage debate and how people are just not being equipped to be able to think through that issue biblically. Well, let me try and be brief. Situation ethics goes back to Joseph Fletcher in the 1960s, who was an Episcopal priest who was a lecturer at the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I think. And he wrote a whole lot of 10 books and a whole lot of scientific articles. But his big contribution to ethics, if you like, was the idea of situation ethics, which is that the law of love dominates everything else. In other words, that there are certain situations where it is admissible to break moral laws because it's the loving thing to do. Now, so explicitly, there are times when you might commit adultery, end someone's life, tell a lie, steal something, but be acting in love. So that was his original idea. And he said this as an Episcopal priest. Now, moving from that starting point, he then became an atheist, joined the Euthanasia Society and the Eugenics Society, and was an original signatory to the Humanist Manifesto. But I think his ideas of that, you know, all that matters is love, and that you can reinterpret morality in terms of that, still really hold sway in the church. And I think it's a profoundly wrong idea and can be rebutted from Scripture. The second thing, cheap grace, this is from Bonhoeffer and his book The Cost of Discipleship, which you've read it. Bonhoeffer was a German dissident during the Second World War who was hanged because of his role in a plot to overthrow Hitler, but he was, of course, quite a theologian as well. And that book begins with the sentence, "Cheap grace is the deadly enemy of the church." And what Bonhoeffer argues is that Christians have quite rightly emphasized the fact that we're saved by grace through faith, and that this is not our own doing, it's God's gift, and that we can't boast. You know, we all know Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. But he said that having been saved, that we are then called to a life of repentance and following Christ, and that we're called to be holy. We're a holy nation, a royal priesthood, and that we're to walk in his footsteps. And what he's saying is that cheap grace, the idea that, you know, we're saved and then can affect that our lives and what we do doesn't really matter, is heretical. And I think he's right about that. That grace is costly in the sense that it calls us to a life of obedience, and it cost Christ to save us. And then diversity, the third one, this is the idea that ethics is a kind of secondary issue, you know, in a Romans 14 sense. You know, Paul talks about not judging one another for our views over, and he uses the two examples of the food we eat and the way we esteem various days of the week. And of course, this is the basis of the interesting discussions we have about what's primary or core within evangelicalism and what is secondary. In other words, that there are issues on which we might choose to disagree, and in those areas we have to be careful not to judge one another and to respect one another, and especially those who are strong, to respect those who are weak, and so on and so forth. And of course, that leads to lots of interesting discussions about what's in that secondary category. And most, we were talking about this the other day in the round table, and people were generally agreeing there that it includes things like the amount of water used and timing in baptism, for example, you know, or your views on eschatology. Are you pre-mill, post-mill, a-mill, or pan-mill? In other words, you believe it's all going to pan out in the end. You know, the Lord's Supper, the way it's practiced, ecclesiology, views about church structure, the role of women, the place of Israel, and we all know the kind of things. So the key question to be asked here is morality a secondary issue? Because we've just had this interesting debate in the UK, which will be ongoing, where there are a group of so-called progressive evangelicals who are arguing that sexual morality is a secondary issue on which Christians can choose to disagree. So when that applies, you can see how that applies to the area of gay marriage. So they'll say, okay, well, we endorse gay marriage, you don't, and we respect that, but we're still all evangelicals together, and you shouldn't judge us. Now, again, I think that's profoundly mistaken, and it's not at all biblical, because the New Testament makes it very clear that those who continue to do certain things will not be included in the kingdom of God. And we see at the end of Revelation that even though we're saved by grace, judgment is on the basis of works. Who are those outside the city? Well, they are the murderers, idolaters, sexual immorality, and so on and so forth. So I think my own view is that situation ethics, cheap grace, and what I've called here diversity, but now you understand what I mean by it, are mistaken teachings that are quite damaging. And I think part of the reason why we don't engage in ethical discourse as much as we should, and I think to a large extent the Roman Catholics put us to shame over this. And I, much as I disagree with Catholic doctrine on a whole range of different levels, but I've found in my own work, and I do a lot of stuff in advocacy and public policy, a lot of media stuff, and when we're advocating on beginning or end of life issues or on these complex areas of bioethics, it's noticeable that our main co-belligerents are Roman Catholics rather than other evangelicals. And that deeply saddens me. Because I think that evangelicals should be leading in this area. But I think that we haven't done our homework properly. Anyway, so there we are. Is that okay?
Do you have a bit of time for questions?
We've got a naturalist worldview, but secular humanist ethics. And yet you can't get an ought from an is. And there's a really interesting disconnect there that the new atheists, like Dawkins and Hitchens and so on, for some reason they have adopted the secular humanist ethical framework, and yet it's difficult to see how they've got that from this. No? So there's a profound disconnect that I think we can expose and question.
Thank you.
So the point's just being made that in terms of a basis for, you know, human or for Christian morality, the example of Luke 4, where Christ shows his compassion alongside the preaching of the gospel by healing people from every single person who came to him, indiscriminately, whether they responded to the gospel message or not, and that he sought their complete healing. But the fact that they didn't necessarily respond to spiritual healing, this is where the whole thing of walking in the footsteps of Christ, we don't have his gifts. No, as a doctor, I see it as divine stewardship, if you like, that we understand science, we develop technology, we use this technology to serve, and in so doing, we're doing the work of God. So, you know, whether you, in the same way, whether you feed people by multiplying fish and bread or by catching fish and making bread, it doesn't matter. And in the same way, if you heal miraculously or you're using surgery or medicine, it's all equally God's work. Just for the tape, the comment is emphasizing the importance of opposing this doctrine of cheap grace. And I think it's all there in Paul. And Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, for by grace you've been saved by faith, is not your own doing, it's the gift of God, not because of works, lest any man should boast, is followed by Ephesians 2, 10. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for what? Good works. So, and every one of Paul's letters begins with several chapters of theology and then several chapters of ethics. Yes, the question is asking with regard to the Declaration of Geneva and the International Code of Medical Ethics similarly, to what extent they're binding today, because many doctors are facing issues of conscience where they're being forced to do things they regard as unethical. And I think it's deeply ironic, really. But there's no question that in the last 60 years, the medical profession has completely changed its view, so that it now stands in a position which is directly opposed to the Declaration of Geneva, especially with regard to abortion. And there are many who would want to embrace or to oppose the Declaration of Geneva with regard to euthanasia as well. And so we have the deeply ironic situation where in some jurisdictions, doctors who wish to abide by the Hippocratic Oath and Declaration of Geneva are being discriminated against. Now, we saw this most recently in Britain when the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Health, which is part of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, has put out new guidelines with regard to its postgraduate qualifications. And you cannot now get a diploma in sexual and reproductive health or undergo specialist training in sexual and reproductive health unless you are prepared to provide the full range of contraceptives. Now, that includes some contraceptives like the IUCD and certain forms of postcoital contraception, notably Ulipristal, marketed as Alawan, both of which we know act by, or at least can act, by destroying an embryo after the time of fertilization. Now, many Catholics, many evangelicals would say that they will not fit IUCDs or prescribe Ulipristal, and they would say that, in fact, the Declaration of Geneva supports them in doing that, because they've pledged to maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception. And it's interesting that the Declaration of Geneva goes on to say, even against threat. And what's ironic is that that threat is now coming from our own royal colleges. And in many countries in Europe, the laws of the country. So in Britain, we have a conscience clause in the Abortion Act so that people can't be forced to do abortions. But I know in some countries in Europe, there isn't that kind of conscience. And that's why I think it's so important for us to be fighting for good conscience legislation and arguing for reasonable accommodation of people with views so that people aren't forced to do what they believe is wrong. The question is, are we coming to a situation where Christians are going to be excluded from public positions? I would say that that's a threat and that we should never be intimidated by a threat. And I don't think the situation that we're in now and the situation that's developing in a world hostile to Christian faith and values is any different from the situation that's been faced by Christians throughout history and by people in biblical times. Joseph, Nehemiah, Esther, Mordecai, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, you could go on. All of these people who held positions of great responsibility in regimes that were largely hostile to Christian theism. And yet they did it. But the issue is there was a cost. And as we see in Babylon and in Persia, the law changes and it has big repercussions. So in Daniel 3, the fiery furnace, the law changes to force these men to do something they believe is wrong. In Daniel 6, the lion's den, the law changes to stop Daniel doing something he believes is profoundly right, that is part of his normal Christian behaviour. And so what we're going to see, and we are already seeing this, I believe, is changes in the law which will force Christians to do what's wrong and will stop them, will criminalise normal Christian behaviour, prayer, worship, assembly, all this sort of stuff. And how do we respond? Well, we respond as they did. We must not be intimidated. We obey God, we count the cost, and we may end up like Daniel and his three friends being delivered, or we may equally end up like Isaiah being, or Zechariah being sawn in half, or whatever. But God is equally glorified in both. But the important thing is that we count the cost, that we're not intimidated, and that we get involved in society and don't withdraw into escapist ghettos. Well, democracies are always at the mercy of well-organized minorities. Democracies are at the mercy of well-organized minorities. And I think, in large part by default, we have allowed a well-organized minority, and they are a minority, to get into the positions of power in the mountains of our cultures and to have their way. And we must not withdraw, we must engage. Because, as you say, there's many people in the middle who can be persuaded when they hear the arguments. But they will only hear them if we make them. Thank you, Peter.